I think just a little reflection should suggest to all of us that, in fact, that's a very problematic, difficult task lying ahead. And in fact, it is very problematic and it is very difficult. It's going to take Plato the remainder of the Republic, all 9 additional books of the Republic, to answer it. Now, at this point in the opening scene, Cephalus has had enough. He leaves. He says, perform a religious sacrifice. He's a rather smiling, rather satisfied, rather peaceful man. He's very wealthy. He's not afraid of death. And he, once confronted by Socrates' intrusive series of questions, he's had enough and he just leaves. Now, again, that's a very small, dramatic moment, but it signals an important theme. And the theme is this: what sort of human being can become a philosopher? What sort of human being has the intellectual energy to pursue questions that are as difficult as Socrates' what is it question? Cephalus is clearly not a philosopher. Immediately after leaving, Polemarchus, his son, replaces him. He rescues his father from the clutches of Socrates. He proposes a definition of justice. Remember, Cephalus' definition has already been refuted. He proposes that, to quote, it is just to give back what is owed, and he then revises this definition slightly to that it is just to give to everyone what is fitting. That's from 332b. Now, Socrates then refutes this definition, and that refutation takes place between 332b to 336a. We don't have the time to analyze it. I would urge you to read those arguments carefully and see if you think that Socrates does a good job refuting those definitions. One reason I don't want to spend time on that refutation is because in this second lecture, I want to at least mention the name of the next character who will appear in Book 1. And that character is Thrasymachus. Thrasymachus teaches rhetoric. He is a sophist. I mentioned the sophists in Lecture 1. And when we begin Lecture 3, I'll begin by discussing sophistry in general and Thrasymachus in particular.
Lecture 3, Book 1, Socrates versus Thrasymachus.
I'd like to start Lecture 3 exactly from where I left off at the end of Lecture 2, with Thrasymachus, who appears in Book 1 of the Republic. You recall that Socrates has successfully refuted Cephalus and Polemarchus. He's refuted their attempts to define justice. And now Thrasymachus enters the scene. Let's begin with his definition of justice. From 338c, he defines the just as the advantage of the stronger. It's a very famous definition of justice, and it's well worth spending a few minutes over it. The first thing I'd like to try to explain is why that definition shows Thrasymachus to be a sophist. I want to explain now what I promised I would explain, really, what is it to be a sophist? That definition is a relativistic one. And here's what I mean by that. To describe justice as the advantage of the stronger is to say that justice is relative to the ruling power, to the ruling body. So, just to give an example, in China, we have a rule by the Communist Party. Justice in China, according to Thrasymachus' definition, is what is advantageous to the stronger, namely to the rulers of the Communist Party. In America, we have a democracy. The stronger, in an important sense, is the people who have voted in their elected representatives. What is just in a democracy, according to Thrasymachus, is what is advantageous to the people. Now, it's very likely that what justice is in China, again, operating with Thrasymachus's definition, is different from what justice is in America. Easy example, free speech. That's counted as a right and an important part of justice in our country. If someone violates my right to free speech, I claim that that person is being unjust. In China, however, free speech is not valued in the same manner. According to Thrasymachus, justice in China, which includes the prohibition in some cases of free speech, and justice in America, which affirms the sanctity of free speech, those are two different conceptions of justice, each of which is equally valid in the regime. Why is each equally valid? Because justice is the advantage of the stronger. So this is a definition which is regime relative. There is no absolute conception of justice, according to a relativist like Thrasymachus. That means that there is no one universal justice. You recall in Lecture 2, when we were discussing the what is it question of Socrates, when he asks the question, what is justice? He may very well presuppose, simply by asking that question, that there is a universal justice. Thrasymachus is answering the question, however he's answering it in a way that almost seems to deny its presupposition. Because according to his relativistic definition, there is no absolute, no universal, no objective definition of justice. Justice is relative to the regime. This sort of relativism goes to the heart of the Greek sophists. The Greek sophists were those itinerant teachers of the 5th century and the 4th century. Not all of them were itinerant, but they started off that way. Thrasymachus is a practicing sophist. What that means is that, like all the other sophists, he teaches rhetoric. I'd like to just spend a minute discussing the relationship, because it's an important one, between rhetoric and relativism. Rhetoric is very often defined as the art of persuasion. It's the ability to convince an audience of your position. Rhetoric and relativism go hand in hand. And the reason for this is that if you are a relativist, like Thrasymachus, then you don't believe that there is an absolute, objective, universal justice, or universal goodness, or universal beauty. Nothing is absolute or universal. What that implies is that the only way any value, like justice, or beauty, or goodness, can ever get any credibility, can ever have any force, is if people believe it. If there is no objective justice, no single form of justice that embraces all particular instances of justice, then each particular instance of justice, whether it's communist China, where free speech is denied, or democratic America, where free speech is encouraged, each of those forms of justice gets its power from the power of rhetoric, from the power of persuasion. That's the only game in town, if I could put it that way, to describe what happens if you're a relativist. If you're a relativist, you have no way of proving that your ideas about justice or beauty or goodness are absolutely right, because of course you deny there's any such thing as the absolutely right. The only thing you can do is persuade people that they should believe you're right. And that's what rhetoric does. So what the 5th century and the 4th century sophists did was teach usually young men who very often had a political career in mind. These were ambitious young men who wanted to be able to persuade other people of their views. Thrasymachus was one such teacher. He was a professional rhetorician. All of those ideas, I think, are compressed and built into this very simple definition. The just is the advantage of the stronger. Let's take a look at how Socrates attacks this definition. And I'll begin with an argument that appears at the lines 339a to 340a. Now, what Socrates does, and this is typical Socratic procedure, is he asks his opponent questions. And then his opponent gives an answer, which becomes an answer they agree on. So Socrates asks Thrasymachus, is it just to obey all laws? And Thrasymachus says, yes, it is just to obey all laws. Now, it should be clear, I hope, from the definition that Thrasymachus is operating with, justice is the advantage of the stronger, why he says that. If that is all that justice is, the advantage of the stronger, if justice is relative to the regime, then of course it would be just to obey every single law, because the law is made by the stronger. So in communist China, it would be just to obey the law that prohibits free speech. In democratic America, it's just to affirm the value of free speech and to not infringe on anyone else's right to free speech. Okay, so that's the first item in their agreement. Socrates then asked Thrasymachus, don't rulers, those who are stronger in any given regime, don't rulers sometimes make mistakes? Thrasymachus answers, yes. Of course, that's common sense. People make mistakes. Well, what happens when a ruler makes a mistake? A ruler then creates a law that actually is disadvantageous to the ruler. Let me give an example. Let's say I'm a ruler. Let's say I'm a tyrant. I'm the sole ruler of my country. So I'm the stronger. Therefore, what is just, according to the definition, is what is towards my advantage. You, the subjects, ought to obey me because it's just to obey all laws. Now, I'm going to make a law. I'm going to raise the tax rate to 50%. You have to give me 50% of all of your income. I can do that because I'm the tyrant. And I'm doing it because I think it's to my advantage. I'd like the money. It would please me a lot. However, at some point, this law backfires. And it turns out I, the tyrant, have made a terrible mistake. I've impoverished the citizens. They're very angry, and there's a revolution, and my regime is toppled. So it turns out that in this case, obeying the law, which the citizens did, turns out to be to my, the ruler's, disadvantage. So the situation is now very confused. Thrasymachus, in other words, has contradicted himself. He has said, he has agreed that it is just to obey all the laws. He has agreed that rulers sometimes make mistakes and make bad laws, laws that are disadvantageous to them. Therefore, it is just to act towards the advantage of the ruler and towards the disadvantage of the ruler, both. And that's a contradiction. Justice both is and is not advantageous to the ruler. This is the Socratic Elenchus, the art of refutation, at its best. Socrates has shown that his opponent is contradicting himself. Or another way to put it, in less formal terms, is Socrates has shown that his opponent doesn't know what he's talking about. So Thrasymachus's definition has been defeated. It's been defeated on the very simple idea that rulers sometimes make mistakes. At this point, there's a very interesting, although brief, interruption in the dialogue. And I'm referring to line 340b. And here we find a character named Cleitophon. And Cleitophon offers his assistance to Thrasymachus. He says, Thrasymachus, I can get you out of your jam. You're in trouble. Why don't you say this? Instead of saying justice is the advantage of the stronger, your definition, why not say, and I quote, justice is what the stronger believes to be his advantage. Now, that's a change that's so subtle that in your own reading, you may simply run by it without noticing it. In fact, that's a fundamental change. Thrasymachus insists that justice is what is actually to the advantage of the stronger. Cleitophon says, no, justice is what the ruler believes or thinks is advantageous. You see, what Cleitophon is doing with this new definition is eliminating the possibility of making a mistake. Thrasymachus had granted that it was possible to make mistakes. That's how his first definition got refuted. Cleitophon says there's no such thing as a mistake. In other words, the way I would put this is Cleitophon is a more extreme or radical relativist than Thrasymachus. For Cleitophon, there is nothing at work except the beliefs of the ruler. Whatever the ruler thinks is good is good. What Thrasymachus has retained in his own definition, justice is the advantage of the stronger, is some measure of objectivity. And what I mean by that is, Thrasymachus has allowed for the possibility that the ruler can be wrong. The tyrant, in my example, when he raised the tax rate to 50%, actually made a mistake. Objectively speaking, he was wrong because that tax increase worked to his disadvantage. According to Cleitophon, there's no such thing as a mistake. It's whatever the ruler believes counts as just. Now, interestingly, this is the only little speech that Cleitophon ever gives in the entire Republic. He pops his head up, utters these few words, and then leaves. He doesn't literally leave. We don't know if he stayed or not, but we do know that he's silent. And I think that's a very interesting move on Plato's part. Because I think what he's suggesting is that when you have a relativist as extreme as Cleitophon, he can't be refuted. How could you refute somebody who believes what Cleitophon believes? In a very important sense, Cleitophon's relativism is so extreme that it's simply not interesting. If justice is simply what the ruler believes, then every single regime is automatically just. Every time the ruler says anything, believes anything, that counts as justice. That's not a very interesting or persuasive account of justice. And Thrasymachus rejects Cleitophon's assistance. The difference between Cleitophon and Thrasymachus I can now formulate a little differently. Remember, Thrasymachus is a teacher. He teaches rhetoric. Therefore, Thrasymachus is a believer in knowledge. A teacher must believe in knowledge because that's how a teacher makes his living. Thrasymachus, like all sophists, receives tuition payments. In fact, you can make a very good living in Athens if you're a sophist, but you've got to be able to deliver the goods. What are the goods? The goods is knowledge. So Thrasymachus never wants to give up the possibility of objective knowledge. And in that sense, Thrasymachus is not an extreme relativist. Thrasymachus, I might even say this, is confused about who he is. In his own way, Cleitophon is much more clear about himself than Thrasymachus is. Socrates takes advantage of Thrasymachus's confusion and refutes him. What Thrasymachus suggests is that the ruler is like a craftsman. And I'm referring now to 340e. A craftsman is someone who has real knowledge. The Greek word for craft is techne. Very interesting word. It's the root of our words technical and technology. This word, depending on what translation you're using, is often translated as art. Not art as in the fine art of painting, but art as in the liberal arts, forms of knowledge. Once again, we see Thrasymachus is a guy who really appreciates the value of knowledge, unlike Cleitophon. Socrates takes advantage of this fact about Thrasymachus, and he refutes him again. I'm referring now to 341c to 342e. A ruler, says Socrates, agreeing with Thrasymachus, is like a craftsman. He has a techne, a craft, or an art. All craftsmen, says Socrates, and Thrasymachus agrees, are directed toward the advantage of their object. That may sound peculiar. What Socrates means, however, I think can be easily illustrated by an example. If I'm a doctor, I have a craft, I have a techne, I have knowledge. My knowledge is exerted on behalf of the patient, those who are sick. If I'm a pilot of a ship, and this was an extremely important form of knowledge in ancient Greece, then my knowledge is exerted on behalf of the sailors on the ship. I want to make sure, and I use my knowledge on behalf of, making sure that the ship is safe. Socrates generalizes, and he says, and I'll quote now from 341d, that all craftsmen are naturally directed towards seeking and providing for the advantage of the object of their techne, not themselves. So you see, Thrasymachus's definition is justice is the advantage of the stronger. So if I'm the ruler, what's just is what is to my advantage. So you can think of this as a rebound effect. What interests Thrasymachus is what justice gets for me, the ruler. Socrates is saying, no, listen, Thrasymachus, you can't have it both ways. You've said that justice is like a craft. Not surprising you said that. You're a teacher of rhetoric. You believe in craft. You believe in knowledge. If that's the case, if justice is like a craft, like a techne, then it can't have that rebound effect. That's not what a craft does. You can think of it as in somewhat spatial sense, as I'm suggesting with this image of a rebound. What I mean by rebound is that the advantage of ruling for Thrasymachus comes back to him. It's a kind of loop. Whereas when you have a craft, it's a line. It's a straight line. I have the knowledge, I'm a doctor, and I benefit the patient who is sick. With this argument, Socrates defeats Thrasymachus, or at least Thrasymachus believes he's defeated, gets very annoyed with Socrates. Socrates, as perhaps you're finding out in your reading and in our discussions, is an annoying person. And so what does Thrasymachus do? He does what a lot of people do when they're in an argument. He changes his position. He says, the heck with this. I'm not going to try to define justice anymore. I'm going to say something very different. I'm going to say that, in fact, injustice is superior to justice. I mean, all along, this idea of advantage has been in the back of his mind. And so now he simply asserts that injustice is more powerful. It embraces a higher form of freedom. It's more masterful than justice. This is a direct challenge of the highest order to Socrates. What Thrasymachus is saying is something that many of us have often thought about, I'm sure. He's saying, look, I'll put this very colloquially. Justice, being good to other people, being fair, respecting other people, that's for suckers. That's what you do if you're weak. You do that because you're really afraid of somebody doing it to you. But if you were a really tough guy, if you were really strong, if you were really powerful, you'd be thoroughly unjust and just get all the advantages for yourself. With this question, we get to what you might call the second beginning of the Republic. I said earlier that with the what is it question, what is justice, we get the first real beginning of the Republic. With this second challenge by Thrasymachus, who challenges the very goodness of justice itself, we have the second beginning, because now the task laid upon Socrates is to defend the goodness of justice. In other words, he has to explain why someone should prefer to be just rather than being unjust. So, to prefigure an argument that is going to come very shortly, imagine that you could be completely unjust and you would never get caught. Why should you be just? This is a thought experiment that we're going to see very shortly. I'll explain what that means in just a few minutes. Well, Socrates is still attempting to refute Thrasymachus. Now Thrasymachus has said injustice is superior to justice, and he offers a third refutation of the sophist that occurs between 345e and 346e. And just to very briefly review some of the steps. Ruling, Thrasymachus has agreed, is like a craft or an art. It's a techne. People who have a craft or art receive wages for their work. So a doctor, for example, gets paid. What this implies, Socrates says, is that their work is not simply for their own advantage. In other words, if I'm a doctor, I insist on getting paid. Why? Because my work benefits not me, but the person who's sick. The person who's sick gets better. I get rewarded for my work by getting a wage. Well, says Socrates, asking Thrasymachus, don't rulers get wages? Yes, of course they get wages, says Thrasymachus. What does that mean? It means that ruling must be like medicine. It doesn't benefit the ruler, it benefits those who are ruled. Now, with this argument, again, and many others in Book One, which if you've read it, you'll know that they get very complicated, but now Thrasymachus is officially defeated with this argument. However, and perhaps this is apparent from our discussion, this victory of Socrates rings a little hollow. And he admits as much. By the end of Book One, Thrasymachus is defeated. Thrasymachus, by the way, will essentially not say another word for the next 9 books of the Republic. He's been publicly humiliated by Socrates. He's been refuted. But what sort of victory has Socrates actually achieved? Socrates himself admits that he hasn't really completed the task. He says, look, maybe I beat Thrasymachus in the sense of Thrasymachus has given up, but I haven't done 2 things. And these are the things I'm really required to do philosophically. Number one, we haven't defined what justice is. We still don't know what justice is. All along, we've been using this word justice without answering the essential Socratic question. What is it? Well, that's a pretty big lapse, Socrates admits. And number two, and I think if you review the arguments that we've discussed in this lecture, you'll see why Socrates says this, we really haven't proven that justice is superior to injustice. Now, Socrates, again, this is the end of Book One and the beginning of Book Two of the Republic, he seems ready to go home. You remember how the Republic opens. I went down to the Piraeus yesterday, and on his way back up to Athens, he was stopped by Polymarchus. Once again, he's ready to go up, to go home. But once again, he's forced to stay down. And by the way, as you might guess, I'm making much of these details of going up and going down because in typical Platonic fashion, these little details foreshadow very large issues that we will discuss when we discuss the famous parable of the cave, which some of you may already have heard of. That's a story that appears in Book 7 of the Republic. In any case, Book 2 opens with Glaucon saying to Socrates, and I'll quote directly from 357a, "Socrates, do you want to seem to have persuaded us, or truly to persuade us, that it is in every way better to be just than unjust?" Now read that question again carefully. What Glaucon is saying is, look, Socrates, maybe you persuaded Thrasymachus to give up, but that's not your job. You're not just a sophist who is only interested in winning a debate, because that is what sophists are most interested in. You're a philosopher. So the issue for you shouldn't be just seeming to persuade us. It should be really persuading us. In other words, it should be really explaining the truth of the matter. And as Socrates himself has acknowledged, that truth would require an answer to the question, what is justice, and a complete explanation of why it's really better to be just than it is to be unjust. Now, as you read the Republic, I suggest you keep your eyes on this guy, Glaucon. He is the driving force of the dialogue. Every time Socrates wants to go home or to stop talking, it's Glaucon that pushes him. Glaucon is courageous, he's spirited, he's aggressive, he's musical. We learn a great deal about this character through the course of the dialogue. What you might want to do at this stage of our reflections is contrast Glaucon, who's keeping the dialogue going at the beginning of Book 2, with Cephalus at the very beginning of Book 1. Recall what I said about Cephalus. He's old, he's satisfied, he's rich, he has no problem in being pursued by the mad passions of Eros. He's very comfortable with the prospect of dying because he's convinced he's going to be well rewarded in the next life. He's utterly self-satisfied, whereas Glaucon is much more, you might say, the prototype of the philosopher. He's aggressive, he's thoughtful, he's unsatisfied with easy answers. He demands that Socrates give him a truly satisfying answer to these questions. When Book 2 opens, what we're faced with is now a monumental task. We're faced with it because, once again, of this aggressive assertiveness of Glaucon. The task is monumental. It will require the entirety of the Republic. We're going to need to prove that it is better to lead a life of justice than it is to lead a life of injustice. And to do that, we will need a thorough account of what justice is.
Lecture 4, Book 2, The City-Soul Analogy.
Glaucon has pushed Socrates hard. He's demanded that Socrates do a better job of refuting Thrasymachus. The refutation of Thrasymachus was successful, but only insofar as Thrasymachus was silenced. As you reread Book 1, ask yourself, were Socrates' arguments really persuasive to you, or did you find some flaws in the arguments? Many scholars believe these arguments are rather seriously flawed. And in fact, I think Socrates might agree with that, because, as I suggested at the end of the last lecture, he himself acknowledges that the job has not been completed. Glaucon is the driving force behind Socrates completing the job. Let's begin by looking at the various ways in which Glaucon pushes Socrates. The first thing he does is the following. Recall that the challenge facing Socrates, to put it very economically, is to prove that justice is good, that it's better than being unjust. Glaucon says there are three different kinds of good things, three different goods. The first are good or desirable for their own sake. The example here that Glaucon gives is a harmless pleasure. Say, for example, that you go outside and you smell the roses that are in front of your house. It's a delight. Nothing harmful comes from it. It's not like the pleasure of drinking a lot of alcohol one night when you pay a great price the next day. This is a pleasure that brings with it no corresponding pain. Just enjoy the fragrance. It's interesting that Socrates himself seems to like this example of smell to illustrate this sort of pleasure. A second kind of good thing is a good thing that is desirable not for itself, but for its consequences. An example would be taking a very unpleasant medicine. It tastes terrible, but you know it's going to make you healthy. So you accept it. You say to yourself, it's good to take this medicine because of the benefits that it will bring. The third kind of good, the most comprehensive kind of good, is that which is desirable both for its own sake and for the sake of its consequences. And here Socrates gives three examples: thinking, seeing, and being healthy. And I'm referring to lines 357c. You think, for example, of being healthy. It's something that's enjoyable on its own. You feel better when you are healthy, analogous to the smell of the roses. But you also have great consequences from being healthy. You can lead a more productive life, get lots more done, etc. The question that Glaucon is asking is, into which of these three categories does justice fit? Now, most people believe it fits into the second category. Most people back then, probably including Glaucon, and certainly most people in the modern period. That second category is the category of good, which states that it is good because of its consequences. Let me explain what I mean by this. And let me use a phrase that is almost defining of political theory, especially in the modern period. And that phrase is the social contract theory. To speak very broadly, the social contract theory begins by assuming that most people really don't want to be just. They don't want to respect their neighbors. They don't want to defer to laws. They don't want to declare allegiance to a government. They have individual desires, individual ambitions, and these are what they really want to pursue, even if it meant doing harm to someone else. However, the cost of the free, unlimited pursuit of individual desires is a situation that invariably brings chaos. And so most people come to realize that they have to enter into a contract where they give up that sort of freedom and in turn receive a kind of security from the state. The state inhibits the freedom of the individual citizens. So the citizens are giving something up, but at the same time, the state protects the individual citizens from the aggressive tendencies of their neighbors. So the social contract theory implies that justice, which emerges from the social contract, is an in-between good. Best of all would be to be completely unjust. This, of course, was Thrasymachus's position. Best is to be unjust. Do what you want, get what you can, maximize your own self-interest, even if it means trampling on others. That's not a tenable position, because if everybody acted that way, we would be in what the great English philosopher Hobbes called the war of all against all. Everybody would just be out to get everybody else. Chaos. Justice is an in-between good because it sacrifices that extreme good for something that is better, namely entering into a social contract for the benefits it brings. The primary benefit is security. You might look at the lines that appear at 359A for an articulation of this notion that justice is in between. Glaucon challenges Socrates to demonstrate that justice is better than that, that justice isn't only an in-between good, but that it is a comprehensive good. It is good for itself, independent of its consequences, and for its consequences. Now, the second way he formulates this challenge to Socrates is by telling a story. And I referred to this a little earlier. Philosophers sometimes call these thought experiments. Philosophers can't perform experiments in laboratories, can't perform experiments on human beings, can't perform experiments in actual history. But what we can do is cook up imaginary experiments in our head, and they've come to be called thought experiments. Glaucon tells us a story which is, in effect, exactly that. It's the story of the Ring of Gyges, and this appears at lines 359D to 360D. Gyges was a shepherd. There was a terrible earthquake, and the earth opened up. Gyges was walking by the chasm. He looked inside. He saw a statue, saw what appeared even to be a corpse. He goes down into the chasm. It's a rather fearless guy, this man, Gyges. And he sees the corpse, and he sees that on the hand of the corpse, on the finger of the corpse, is a ring. So he takes it. Takes the ring, goes back up to the real world. He is fooling around with the ring, and he discovers something extraordinary, and that is that if the ring is turned to face him, if the collet of the ring faces him, he becomes invisible. He turns it away from him, he's back to being visible. And this, naturally, pleases him a great deal. So what does he do? He makes himself invisible, and he sleeps with the queen. He rapes her. And then he kills the king. And then he takes over the kingship with a new queen at his side. So this lowly shepherd, armed with his magical ring, is now the king. And in fact, he's a tyrant. What Glaucon is suggesting with this story is really a challenge to all of us. And I suspect many of us have had this fantasy at different times of our lives. What if we could be invisible? What would we do? What would you actually do if you were possessed of this beautiful, powerful ring? The issue is, if you could commit acts of injustice without suffering any penalty, if no one knew you were being unjust, and as a result, no one could get you, would there be any reason to be just? So that's the question in a nutshell. If you had the Ring of Gyges, would there be any reason left to be just? According to the basics of the social contract theory, there really would be no reason to be just if you had the Ring of Gyges. The only reason we enter into the social contract and agree to obey the rules of justice is precisely because we're afraid of getting caught. I want to steal your goods, your property, but what stops me from doing it is the fact that I'll get punished for doing so. I want to be unjust, but I'm too scared because I fear getting caught. And so, again, as a result, I enter into a contract. I don't steal your property, and now at least I know you won't steal my property. We're both subordinated to a punitive law, a law which applies force. Again, that's the social contract view. Socrates and Glaucon are looking for a much deeper and a much more difficult conception of justice to establish. It has to be a conception of justice in which justice is a good in and of itself, in addition to the consequences that it will bring. Now, you might think that Socrates, who repeatedly has said, "I want to go home." Socrates is not a young man at this stage of the dialogue. He must be somewhere around 60 years old. Glaucon is a rather young man. He's Plato's brother. You recall that Plato was born in 429, though we don't know Glaucon's age, but I'm assuming he's a rather young man. Young people have a great deal of energy. The 60-year-old man, Socrates, seems to want to go home. You would think at this point of the dialogue, he'd be very annoyed with Glaucon, because Glaucon is just heaping on him all this work to do. You've got to explain to me why I should be just, even if I had the ring of Gyges. But instead, and I refer you to line 368a, he is quite impressed by his young friend. Socrates is a strange bird. We're seeing that, I hope. He seems to like being challenged in this intense way by a young man like Glaucon, who, unlike Thrasymachus, who also wants to challenge him, Glaucon seems to want to challenge Socrates to join him, Glaucon, in the quest for the truth. Remember what I said last lecture. A major theme of the Republic is, you might say, to give a personality sketch of the philosopher. The paradigm of the non-philosopher is Cephalus. Doesn't have any energy. Thrasymachus is not a philosopher. He's a sophist. Cleitophon is no philosopher. He disappears. It's Glaucon, who is, I can't say a philosopher, he's too young, but I can say a potential philosopher. And this is why he is Socrates' companion. Well, now Socrates, and we're still at the beginning, really, of Book 2 of the Republic, now Socrates kicks into gear. No more hesitation, no more reluctance. He is committed to the project. And he says the following, and I'm referring now to lines 368c to 369a. He says, "This job that you have given me, namely to show why it's better for someone to be just than to be unjust, that's too big. It's too big. I can't figure out what justice is on the level of the individual." Because that's really what Glaucon is asking. Why should I be just? Why shouldn't I be unjust if I can get away with it? "Too hard," says Socrates, "to get this done in terms only of the individual. But we have, fortunately," he says, "a way to overcome this problem." And here he offers what scholars have long called the city-soul analogy. Before beginning, I better tell you a little bit about this word soul. That's an English word, of course, and it translates the Greek word psuche. That word psuche doesn't quite mean soul as many people would use the English word. You should note that the Greek word is the root of our word psyche, as in psychology. The Greek word can mean mind, it can mean individual, it can mean self, it can mean lots of things. It doesn't simply mean what especially a Christian might mean by the English word soul. It's a very broad term, and I just want to warn you about that. I will use the word soul, but please don't get too fond of associating it with just the ordinary English connotation. I mean, what the soul finally means in Greek is that part of a human being that's really not the body, right? Okay, with that warning in place, let's go forward. Socrates says, we're lucky. We're in a situation that is like someone who had to read very small letters. Imagine what it's like to go into an eye doctor's office and face an eye chart. The very, very bottom, there are extremely small letters. Well, justice in the individual, justice in the soul, is like a very small letter. It's very hard to see. But what if we could find something that contained the same letters, but that was written larger? Well, we have such a fortunate thing in front of us, says Socrates. It's the city, the polis. There is a city-soul analogy. An analogy is a proportionate relationship. The city and the soul are isomorphic. Isomorphic means, literally, having the same shape. So again, just think of the eye chart. At the very, very bottom, there's a tiny E or A, and you can't read it. But if you blow it up and put those same letters at the top, easy to read. The city is like that. Our goal is to understand what justice is and why it's better to be just than to be unjust. And the way we're going to do it is by constructing a just city. This is the construction project that I've mentioned a couple of times. In Book 2, we begin what is likely the most famous side of the Republic, the building, the creation of a perfectly just city. This is sometimes called the city in speech, because obviously it's not a real city. It's a city that's hypothetical. It's a city that's ideal. It's a city that we conjure up with words. The perfectly just city in speech. Remember why we're doing this, just to say it one last time. It's to make our job easier. Easier to see justice in the city than to see it in the soul. But our real goal in this dialogue is to see justice in the soul. Let's begin making a city. Where does the city begin? In the need that people have for each other. And I'm referring now to lines 369b to 372c. This initial city, this first city, is sometimes called the original city, and it's the city of minimal needs. You might just think about this word need, and you might think in your own experiences of how at different junctures in your lives you have needed other people. It's a very common occurrence that people have had, especially in times of, for example, natural disaster. I used to live in Iowa where there were terrible floods. And one thing I remember very clearly during one especially terrible flood was all the neighbors came out of their houses onto the street. We needed each other because we were in danger. There was a lake developing in the park that was just a few blocks away, and we had to decide what to do. What was so striking, of course, was that I saw people I had almost never seen before. I talked to people who lived two blocks away, but I had never talked to. It's in need that political community forms. That's where politics begins. That's what Socrates believes and asserts in this initial stage of his construction project. Well, what are the needs that we have of one another? The most primitive things: food, shelter, clothing, shoes. How is this city, this hypothetical city that meets our needs, how is it organized? Remember, the title of our dialogue is Politeia. What that means is the way a city is organized. The first city, the original city, is organized around a very simple principle. It's the division of labor. Each person in the city has one job, they do that one job, and they share the results of the job with everybody else. So in this city, the builder builds houses, and the shoemaker makes shoes, and everybody else wears the shoemaker's shoes. The shoemaker doesn't build houses, and the builder doesn't make shoes. So this is a simple division of labor that obviously is based on some principle of efficiency. It'd be ridiculous to try to be an excellent shoemaker and an excellent carpenter and an excellent farmer. Everybody has one job, they concentrate on it. So this city which emerges is a very complete city in its own way. Everybody seems, at least the way Socrates sketches it, to be very content. Their needs are met. This is a peaceful city. It's a stable city. There is no competition. There is no government, no military. There are no luxuries. They just have food, clothing, shelter. There's no furniture. Interesting. And there's no meat. This is a vegetarian city. And I mention this point because it becomes important shortly. Now, Socrates seems to like this city. Glaucon, however, and perhaps this won't surprise you because you're getting to know something about this young man, he doesn't like it. He says it's a city of pigs, a city of sows, 372d. And what he means by that is that it's a city that only meets the most basic animal needs that human beings have. And in fact, to be human, says Glaucon, is to want more than food, shelter, and clothing, and shoes. What people really want, says Glaucon, is what he calls relishes. That word appears in 372e, fancy food. People want to go beyond the basic. I think Glaucon is identifying a basic feature of human desire. We're not satisfied with just barley and greens, which is the diet of this particular city. Somebody in that city is going to say, hey, we got to do better than this. Now, notice the words that Socrates uses to describe this first city. I'm referring to 372e. He calls this city, I quote, true and healthy. Whereas he calls Glaucon's city, the city that's going to move beyond mere necessities, the city of relishes, he calls it, I quote, luxurious and feverish. What's in the feverish city? This is the second city, Glaucon's city. The feverish city has perfume. It has courtesans. It has artists of all sorts. It has incense. It has all the luxuries we typically associate with civilized life. In other words, I would say, and I believe Plato would surely agree with me, that the feverish city, that's the word Socrates uses to describe it, Glaucon's city, is realistically human. The first city, which Socrates calls healthy, is too healthy. Human beings aren't like that. In a real city, a realistically human city, human beings want relishes. Now, one other translation of the Greek word, which is I translate as relishes, is also roasted meats. People want meat. Now, that may seem inconsequential, but in fact, it's decisive. Because if you have a community which requires meat, you need more land. You need land for pasturing your animals. In the first city, which Glaucon called the city of pigs, you have land, but it only grows crops for human consumption, and you have animals, but they're used only for labor. In the second city, we want meat, and so there needs to be more land for pasture. What does that mean? That means war. There has to be aggression. The city has to conquer the neighboring city in order to get more land. And this is stated very explicitly by Socrates at 373d. From the inconsequential meat eating to the immensely consequential war. That's the transition. And some of you who are vegetarians might think that, in fact, that first item is not so inconsequential, and perhaps you're right. Let's notice what Socrates says about war, one of the most interesting and sobering lines in the whole Republic. I'm quoting from 373e. He says, "And let's not say whether war works evil or good." He doesn't say, in other words, that war is bad. He doesn't say it's good, but he doesn't say it's bad. Let's keep that in mind. Now, what happens next? Remember, what was the basic principle of the city so far? It was the division of labor. You have one person, one man, and he should do one job. The farmer grows crops, the carpenter builds houses.